Hey, everybody. Welcome to the first ever episode of Towing the Slab, pitching with me, David Cohn. Also, we've got Justin Shackle and James Smythe here to kind of, one's a point guard, one's going to kind of fill in the blanks for me, as he always does, as we do Yankee games together. And we're going to deal with some current issues as well as what's going on in the championship series in Boston with a rout tonight over Houston. And then also talking about baseball's first. You know, scoring first, the first inning for starting pitchers, everything that happens right out of the gates that are so impactful in the course of a game. But nonetheless, welcome to our first show.
Yes, episode one, Towing the Slab, pitching with David Cohn. You just heard David. I'm Justin Shackle, like you mentioned. James Smythe in the house as well. James, what's going on, man?
Hey, good to be here. We're finally kicking off the first episode.
Yeah, maiden voyage, where we talk about pitching. You know, we look to find clarity between some of the new techniques in the analytic age and how that can mesh with the heartbeat of an athlete. And today, like David alluded to, we're talking about some themes that we've seen this postseason as it relates to pitching, themes that happen early on, and themes that happen in the first inning. But David, like we said, it's your podcast, man. Congratulations. And I think you celebrated by hitting the links today, right?
Yes, the Yogi Berra golf tournament. It's a great cause. Yogi's got a museum down at Montclair State University, and you know we've done it for years. You know, Yogi used to play in it. Now his family's kind of carrying on the tradition. So, you know, it's Yogi Berra. I mean, he's one of the players that transcended the game, right? There's little old grandmothers that have heard of Yogi Berra that don't know anything about baseball. So to me, that's kind of the barometer when you have that kind of fame. Yogi's a transcendent sort of a figure in American history.
We hope those little old grandmothers know exactly how to subscribe to podcasts, because that's rule number one right out of the gate. Rate, review, subscribe, right? All that podcast jargon that everyone's heard a million times, well, now we get to say it. And we hope that you do all those three: rate, review, subscribe. It is the best way to make sure that, you know, we're setting out our goals and doing everything that we promise with you. So yes, rate, review, subscribe. New episodes coming out every Tuesday here. How's your golf game going, David? It was like the first real day of fall. You had a lot of wind. That was a factor as well.
How's your golf game today? Let me tell you, it was cold out there. It was the first cold day we've had this year, even though it wasn't temperature wise, but outside it was windy in Jersey today. It was blowing down there, and it was bone chilling for the first feel of that north wind. It certainly got us all a little bit out there today.
All right, we're off and running with this podcast in October, like the best time of the year to obviously talk about baseball, but pitching, it's more specific, because we know pitching dictates the postseason, and we're seeing it again. We're right in the middle of the ALCS and the NLCS. We're recording at the time where the ALCS just wrapped up in game three. The Red Sox took down the Astros 12-3, the final, a no contest after the first three innings or so. And I think it's a good indicator of our topic here. A lot of stuff is happening early on in these games, and it's really leaving some teams in shambles when you look at their pitching staff. So through three games, what do both Boston and Houston's pitching staffs look like? We have a really clear answer right now. The Astros don't look too good. Boston, thanks to the emergence of Eduardo Rodriguez tonight, you know, he pitched a quality start in the postseason. That's like as rare as a Maddox in the regular season. It really puts the Red Sox over the top here. But David, what has stood out to you in terms of pitching throughout this postseason, both the American League and the National League?
You know, I think the theme of this show was going to be, you know, the first of things to come. You know, for me, a starting pitcher, the first inning was always the most difficult one. You know, I thought in tonight's game, even though both teams did not score in the first inning, there was a statement made by Eduardo Rodriguez, how sharp he was, how good his pitches looked, including that backdoor cutter that he throws. When he's got command of that cutter to both sides of the plate, it changes the whole equation for him, because he can throw it in any count at any time, and it's unpredictable because it's in and it's out. It's more of an east and west style of pitch. And, you know, for him, once he gets a feel for that, you can say, he's on tonight. You could see early with Eduardo that he was on. And, certainly the Boston offense, the way they're swinging the bats, that gives a pitcher a lot of confidence as well. But when you're coming out of the bullpen in a big game like that, whether you're the home pitcher or you're the visitor's pitcher, there's two different sets of circumstances. For the home style pitcher, you dictate the pace. You warm up before the game. You have your routine. And then you get to start the game based on your schedule. And it is your schedule, even though Major League Baseball will post a time before the game and say, game time 7:10. Well, the game doesn't start until the starting pitcher throws the first pitch. So the starting pitcher on the home team has that advantage. The starting pitcher on the visiting team has to sort of time his warmups before the game and kind of make sure that he doesn't sit down and get too cold before the top of the first is over. And then you can pitch the bottom of the first. So to me, that's what I always pay attention to. That's what I remember from pitching, a lot of big games was with getting out of the gates, first blood, getting your team off to a good start, allowing your team to score first. How do you translate your warm-up from the bullpen to the game mound? We call it a fresh skin. It's sort of the game mound where there's no spike marks on it. You've got to dig out your holes in the rubber, toeing the slab, as we say, and then get your alignment right. To me, is everything for a pitcher, and it sets the tone for the entire night. So, maybe I harp on this a little much, and if you've heard me broadcast Yankee games, I talk about this a lot. But really, that first inning is the toughest inning for a starting pitcher, and it really sets the tone, and you can really get a read early on what's going to happen that night and how sharp the pitcher is going to be.
Eduardo Rodriguez threw six innings. He gave up three runs, no walks, and seven strikeouts. And you mentioned the scoreless first inning. It looked really clean on paper. If you were watching, though, I think a huge point in this game was the second batter of the game. It was Michael Brantley, and it was a key strikeout, that cutter that you mentioned on the outside corner. It was on a 2-2 count. Rodriguez didn't get the call on the previous pitch. It was really close. And then he came back and nailed the spot for the strikeout. And then Devers made a nice stop on a hard Bregman ground ball that led to a perfect first inning. But getting that strikeout call, the swing and miss, and that strikeout of Brantley, I think that's at the tone for Rodriguez here. And there is the big question. If he could be effective and consume innings, he could be the big X factor of this series now, because you pair him with Evaldi. You have two conventional starting pitchers, right? Grabbing innings, minimizing the workload for the bullpen. And it's like the polar opposite of where the Astros are going through now, where Jose Urquidy lasted just five outs. I think the big stat that jumps out at you tonight, Rodriguez, six innings pitched in game three. The rest of the Houston starters, 5 1/3 innings this entire series.
Yeah, it's so true. And I know, James and I talk about this a little bit during the broadcast that we work together on the Yes Network. But, for me, it's with Rodriguez, you talk about swings and misses. That's kind of the first thing we look at is it gives you a read on the stuff. It's not just about strikeouts. It's how many pitches is he throwing? What kind of command does he have? And how many swings and misses is he getting on all of his pitches? How broad in scope is his stuff playing, and how well is it playing on any given night? And, for me, Eduardo Rodriguez is kind of a momentum pitcher. It's a little bit of a different term that I use, but you could see that once he gets on a roll, he starts throwing all of his pitches for strikes, especially feeding off of that cutter. He kind of pitches off of that cutter to both sides of the plate. Boy, when he gets on a roll, he throws strike after strike. You can almost see his body language on the mound, the human element comes into play, to where his confidence takes over and he just starts filling up the strike zone and just getting on top of the hitters. And to me, that's the key. When you're in attack mode as a pitcher and you could feel it, you can sense it, working fast on the mound, throwing strikes with all of his pitches, and he got on top of that lineup. And then once they gave him six runs in the bottom of the second to work with, boy, it just seemed like, that it was going to be enough for him tonight.
Yeah, it never hurts to have another grand slam from a leadoff hitter like Kyle Schwarber. I want to touch on that in a few moments. But let's look at the NLCS here. Dodgers seem to be in a little bit of trouble here. They're trailing in this series now, and the Braves are up 2-0 going to Los Angeles. So they've ensured themselves that this series is going to end in Atlanta. And there's a lot being made over the Dodgers' decision to have Julio Urías come out of the bullpen, and the Dodgers kind of pivoting in their late game setup with a 4-2 lead, using Urías against the Braves lefty hitters after a lot of context that's built into that. But what did you make of that decision, David?
I think it's easy to second guess it now because it didn't work. You know, Urias has relief experience, at least in the past, and he's that type of a pitcher where he loves to have the ball. I'm sure once they told him about it, he was all for it. I'm sure there was not any reluctance. You know, if you compare or contrast that to maybe the Yankees' plan of an opener last year with, you know, Davey Garcia starting the first inning, then Jay Happ reluctantly coming in the second inning and watching him warm up before that particular game, there was no buy-in from it. So I think the Dodgers had full buy-in from Urias. I just think it didn't work out in that particular game. And that's so easy to second guess. You know, the fact that it didn't work out, he's a starter, you got him out of his routine. Well, you know, he's a pitcher first. You're a pitcher first, and it's the postseason. And you're willing to do anything at that point. And he's done it in the past. So, you know, I think the Dodgers think outside of the box. They're obviously analytically driven. You know, and James could probably get into this a little bit more in terms of, you know, the strategies as they change and from regular season to postseason and how the managers manage a little bit differently in the postseason. But certainly, you know, I didn't have a problem with it at the time, and I'm reluctant to second guess it now just because it didn't work.
Well, Urias, he has experience starting and relieving. He was great in the postseason last year for the Dodgers during their championship run, and he closed out the series against the Rays. And he was used to some unconventional usage just in the previous series. The last minute switch to Corey Knebel before to make the start in Game 5, and Urias came in after Knebel and Brustar Graterol and pitched a great four innings in San Francisco for to really key the Dodgers win there in Game 5. And the one issue I would have is, and you saw it a little bit with Max Scherzer last night in Game 2 in Atlanta, how much does it compromise the starter for their next game? So Scherzer slammed the door in Game 5, and he was not right last night, and he kind of had a little bit of an early exit than you'd expect for a future Hall of Famer like Scherzer. And he said it, you know, it changed his preparation, and it was an issue for him there. And now how does last night's appearance change for Urias going into the next game, his next scheduled start, whether it's Game 4 or Game 5?
See, that's what I'm hung up on. Scherzer, you know, you can't nitpick because, look, they had him pitch the ninth inning in a Game 5. They were leading 2-1. Do what you need to do to get to the next round, right? In Urias's case, he threw 59 pitches in that game on Thursday. He had the 2 days of rest. Apparently, he told the front office during the Game 5 celebration over San Francisco, again, he's available any role at any time. I think, David, that goes back to your point. You know, you're a pitcher first. You're going to have that mindset. But you have to factor in Blake Treinen needing only 9 pitches to get through that seventh inning in his second day of work. And you have Urias slated to start Game 4. So, like, my biggest question is all this, and I know he's worked in relief in the past, and if it works, you know, we're not talking about it. But it didn't work. And it's not the only example. I know, David, you mentioned Jay Happ, Davey Garcia. That's an example that, you know, hits closer to home for us, all our ties with the Yankees. You know, you look at the Rays and Shane McClanahan earlier this postseason. Again, he had experience in the past working out of the bullpen, not this season. And I get wanting the matchups, but what do you think teams are so willing? Why are they so willing to put pitchers in largely unfamiliar roles during the most important games of the postseason? Where has the trust gone in these situations?
These are valid points. Yeah, absolutely. And well stated on both your parts, you know, James and Justin. It makes you wonder the overall strategy with the Dodgers, in particular with the Dodgers, just to kind of nail down to the heart of the matter here. Maybe they're going to go with an opener again. Maybe they feel like they can limit the pitcher at bats offensively with the non-DH games against the National League teams, you know, where the pitcher only is hit once. Maybe they see a real benefit there. Maybe they also see the benefit in, you know, maybe continuing on with that opener strategy. Maybe Urias doesn't actually get a clean start in his next outing. Maybe they do opt for Blake Treinen or somebody else to open, somebody like that to open the game for them again. So it makes me wonder that the Dodgers are up to something. If there's a chance to get a platoon advantage, if you can flip-flop a lineup early, if there are teams that really rely on maybe more of a platoon situation like the Rays or the Giants, exactly. That's probably why the strategy was so appealing to the Dodgers in that category or in that situation, because they could really put the pressure off the opposing team on lineup construction and mess with them a little bit early and force their hand a little bit early. So, yeah, it feels like there's a lot of chefs in the kitchen with the Dodgers, right? There's a lot of analytical information. There's a lot of top to bottom. And I think one of the most interesting statements and one of the most honest statements came from Dave Roberts, who said, you know, he admitted he used the term tippy top. You know, these decisions are coming from the tippy top on down. And he's one of the first managers that have ever said that. And even admitted, he said, I have a vote, but that's all I really have. I have one vote here. This is the Knights of the Round Table. You know, that's my expression that make these decisions. So kind of makes you wonder what the Dodgers are up to.
I get that, like, you know, organizations don't care what the aesthetics are with winning, right? They want to get to the bottom line. And with that, it feels like each pitching staff is kind of in a bind right now. It's a war of attrition. The postseason's become a war of attrition. When you look at the Dodgers, though, they have like the three starting pitchers that you would typically search for in the postseason, Urias and Buehler and Scherzer. So then they do some stuff like this and you're like, why? You know, like their overthinking is making me feel like I'm overthinking. And I can't be the only one, especially when you see right on the other side of the field what the Braves are doing. Like, what do you think about some of the teams that are still trying to employ their starting pitchers the conventional way? We saw it with the Braves and you saw in game three with the Red Sox.
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent point and very debatable. I mean, that's why people have podcasts, right? So we can talk about these issues and debate them. There's an expression, you know, when I played for the Mets back in the 80s and Davey Johnson was the manager and Buddy Harrelson was the third base coach. And they talked about, it's so tempting to overmanage. Sometimes the best thing you can do is just get out of the way and let the players play and then adjust as you go. And, you know, that's to your point, Justin. Maybe, you know, when you have a massive staff of analysts that the Dodgers employ, it's hard for them not to analyze, right? Analysts are going to analyze and they're going to have their two cents in there. And it's hard not to try to leverage your resources and use every angle you can to come up with some sort of an advantage. And that's understandable. That's what they're there for. That's what they're built to do. But you're right, Justin, that is debatable that in a big game, maybe maybe we just get out of the way and let the game take over and then adjust as we go. That's one strategy that the first time I heard that was from Davey Johnson, who was one of the early progressive first managers with a computer on his desk, kind of a guy back in the 80s and early 90s who actually looked at numbers and matchups and tried to get ahead of the curve and get any edge he could. But sometimes you can overplay your hand at times.
I like how you're pointing back to your time with the Mets, David, because it just creates a beautiful segue here. And I obviously, you know, we're talking about teams scoring first this postseason. That's the main theme of our first episode. And for a pitcher, what it means to get over the hump in that first inning, so to speak. So I want to ask you, David, what is the significance of October the 5th, 1988 to you?
Oh, geez. October the 5th, 1988. You know, 1988, I think about facing the Dodgers in the playoffs, you know, because – you know, back then there wasn't a wild card and it was like, right, boom, you go right to the seven round series and then right to the World Series after that. So I remember an eventful Dodgers series that was up and down. And I remember learning some hard lessons, you know, in that particular series. And, you know, I still think back to 1988 as a missed opportunity for the Mets, one that we let get away.
If you're in the neighborhood, it was game two of the NLCS. It was your first ever postseason game, and it was at Dodger Stadium, game two NLCS. Do you remember, I mean, postseason, you know, you make 21 appearances, 18 starts in your postseason career, but do you remember what was going through your mind as you got closer to making that first pitch in that first postseason game?
Yeah, you know, it really reminds me that, and I think maybe the Tampa Bay Rays ran into this a little bit with their great young pitchers, but lack of experience. And experience does matter in big, especially in big games, because everything's so magnified. Every pitch matters. Every hitter just grinds out every at bat. So yeah, I remember being extremely nervous. There were some extenuating circumstances with my particular first start on October 5th, 1988. I had done a ghost-written column with Bob Clappish, and it became bulletin board material for the Dodgers. So once I found that out before the game, that made me even more nervous. And that was one of the first times that I walked out to pitch the first inning where my legs were physically heavy. I mean, nerves clearly were impacting me at that point. And, you know, certainly I've been nervous before, and, you know, I guess you could say, you know, I choked here and there in certain games or let the pressure get to me. I think every athlete does. But that was the one game I can remember physically being inhibited from nerves. It was a big impact on my performance in that game.
What was different about subsequent postseason starts?
I think once you've gone through something like that, and then you come out the other end, and, you know, the next game, game six, I came back and pitched a good game and kept us in the series. I think that kind of was a growing experience for me on the human element side. There's no substitute for experience. There's only so many lessons you can learn from pitching coaches or from videos or from analytics. Certain lessons you have to learn for yourself on the mound in the heat of the battle out there. And you get what I call kind of a light bulb effect that, you know, hey, I can do this. This pitch works, or this sequence works, or I'm good enough to get this done. And, you know, sometimes that's all it takes. It's just an opportunity and a chance. But until you go through it, until you warm up in the Dodger Stadium bullpen before the game and hear the fans yelling at you, until you get on that mound in the first inning and face a lineup and feel the butterflies of the first of everything, but you can't really understand what it feels like because you've never been through it. And if you've never been through it, then you're susceptible to mistakes. You're susceptible to, not being at your best.
Yeah, James, this postseason, we're learning a lot, right? Like, there's a lot of momentum to be gained within the first inning on both sides of the ball and in being the team that scores first. So as of Tuesday morning, you know, after this game three ALCS, the team who scores first this postseason, they are 18-6. What else are we learning through some stats that you don't really need to dig deep to find, you know, in terms of context? What are we learning about the first inning in these games?
Well, right. And just a little context on the 18-6. Typically, the team that scores first wins about 2 out of 3, during the regular season. So with this year, it's even a little bit higher because it's more like 3 out of 4 with an 18-6 record. But if we just look at the first inning in this postseason and compared to years past and regular season play, the first inning, the old adage, oh, you got to get him early, got to get him in the first inning, that's a real thing. The first inning has more runs scoring at a higher rate than about 10% higher than the rest of the game from the second inning on. So the first inning, you get more runs. Now, that could be some unfamiliarity with the pitcher. David, you talked about that with the home pitcher versus the road pitcher. It's also the one inning where you can guarantee that here are my three batters that I want to send up to the plate. So you're facing a higher caliber hitter than you might face in the second or third inning when you're facing the bottom of the lineup. So the run scoring's higher. The ERA in the first inning is about a half run higher, generally, over the years. About a half run higher than it is overall. This year, the first inning ERA in the postseason through game three of the ALCS, through Monday night's action, is 5.25. It's a 5.25 ERA across all 24 games so far in the MLB postseason. The overall ERA after that is 4.12. So you have more than a run higher on the first inning ERA. So there's a big jump this year. Could part of it be some less experienced pitchers like Shane Baz in the ALDS? He gave up a couple runs early, but then even a veteran like Chris Sale gives it right back with five runs, including the Jordan Luplow grand slam. We saw really established star pitchers get burned. Most significantly in our neck of the woods with the Yankees losing in Fenway, Gerrit Cole couldn't get through that first inning unscathed with the two run homer to Xander Bogaerts. Even Walker Buehler, the first inning of that great Dodger Giants series, Buster Posey, Oppo, almost hit into the cove. He hit it on a bounce, big two run shot there. So, and then we even saw it in this series, the Red Sox Astros series, with JD Martinez hitting the grand slam the other day in game two. So it really is, it's almost like no one's getting away unscathed. So we have star pitchers like Cole and Buehler, younger, less experienced pitchers like Baz and Garcia. Drew Rasmussen gave up a big home run to Kyle Schwarber too. So I think it's you're seeing a lot more scoring in the first inning this year.
Yeah, I was able to get this stat on my own. Pat myself on the back here. You had 11 pitchers making their first ever postseason start this year. And, you know, the ERA doesn't jump out at you. It's a combined 3.58 ERA, but they're averaging fewer than four innings of work. Some did get touched up in the first inning, obviously. But, David, how often did those championship teams that you were on stress the importance of scoring first to one another?
We talked about it a lot. It was a rallying cry for a lot of teams in the dugout as you're talking to each other, as you're talking smack, you know, trying to pump each other up. That's one of the things you'd hear, you know, first blood, give us a chance, shut them down. I can still hear Keith Hernandez, shut them down the first, Coney. We're going to get him. We're going to score first. We're going to win this game. And, you know, even though sometimes there's no rhyme or reason to it, it's just banter in the clubhouse or banter in the dugout, I think it really does come down to just, you know, first. It's not only just the first inning, it's the first strike. How about 0-1? You know, 0-1 as opposed to 1-0. I mean, baseball's kind of got a thing for first. I don't have, you know, this is where I like to combine the human side with the analytical side. I can give you from experience my feeling, how I felt emotionally pitching the first inning, really my whole career. You know, and even more importantly, early in my career to the Dodger game you mentioned, you know, back in 1988 and the nerves and everything that goes with that. There's just something about, you know, for a starting pitcher, you wait a week to pitch. You know, there's 162 games in a major league season. I got to pitch in 30 to 35 of them. I got to play 30 to 35 times. The rest of the time I was sitting around watching games and watching other pitchers. So, that anxiety builds up over the course of 4 or 5 days, and you warm up before the bullpen and you're anxiety ridden, wondering how my stuff is. Is my curveball breaking today? How's my control? How's my stuff in the bullpen? Especially younger pitchers really worry about that. You know, boy, do I have my good fastball today? And then when you take it out to the mound to warm up on a completely new mound, the fresh skin, as I said before, I reiterate that, but it's a real thing. You know, pitchers are mechanics, you know, we've got to dig out holes. We've got to get our alignment right. Where am I landing? I've got to get the perfect landing spot, dug out just a little bit in front of the rubber. I've got to where I place my foot and my toe, where I'm towing the slab, where I push off of the rubber. You know, all these things really matter. And then when you start all over after having just warmed up in a bullpen before the game and then going out to that new mound, it takes some time to get a feel for it. A lot of times the bullpen mounds are facing in a different direction than the game mounds. You know, people talk about wind affecting fly balls and home runs. Well, wind affects pitches too. If it's a crosswind at home plate, how windy the day is. If I was throwing into the wind at Candlestick Park, my pitches dove like crazy. My curveball broke 10 feet, you know, with the wind conditions. So that's another thing you have to gauge for a pitcher. And that just adds to anxiety in the first inning, that all these thoughts through your head. I waited a week to pitch. I've got to be right. And then I've got to get all the mechanics right. And I've got to get my mound right. And then I've got to gauge the wind and the effects. And then who's the umpire behind home plate? Can I steal some pitches? Is he going to call the pitch just off the plate? What's his strike zone look like? So all of these things are first that you're finding out in the first inning that lead to me to an advantage for the hitter. The hitter has the advantage because, as James said, the best hitters nowadays, especially in today's modern lineups, the best hitters are your first three hitters. You know, there's no mistake about it. They're not your fourth or fifth or sixth hitters where the power guys used to be in the middle of the order. It's those guys are ready to go from the first pitch on.
Yeah, I mean, you have – this is very different from facing, like, what, Joey Cora, Kenny Lofton, right? Like, this is Mookie Betts. This is Kyle Schwarber, Randy Arozarena. You have guys that are powering out to lead off a game. How different would your approach be if you're facing that caliber of a leadoff hitter?
Yeah, if you're worried about the first pitch of the game leaving the ballpark, that's not a good thing for the pitcher. It's a good thing for the offense. You know, I can't tell you how many games I pitched in the 80s and even in the 90s where my first pitch of the game was right down the middle. Let's just get a strike here. I don't have to really worry about it. There was maybe a speed burner or maybe a Vince Coleman type of leadoff hitter that was even going to spot me a strike because he wanted to walk or he was trying to get on base any way he could. And that's not what Kyle Schwarber's trying to do. he's trying to leave the ballpark on the first pitch. So if you try to throw that get me over fastball down the middle, you're gonna get burned. By these type of lineups that you see nowadays, the power in the game, certainly both the pitching power, the depth of power arms in the bullpens now. That's why you're seeing starting pitchers throw less and fewer innings because there's more choices, more better pitching. There's more power arms. You know, James and I were doing a game earlier this year, and, Aaron Boone had Jonathan Loaisiga in the game, and he had Clay Holmes warming up. And I said to James, I said, well, they're going to take out the guy who throws a 99-mile-an-hour sinker to bring in the guy that throws a 99-mile-an-hour sinker. I mean, that's what you're dealing with nowadays. You know, these type of arms, this type of power in the bullpens has really changed the way the game is managed and the way the game is played.
You're talking about a lot of the things that goes through a pitcher's mind when you surrender that early run in that first inning. And we can call this like the age of matchups, right? Teams are so locked in on trying to have that pitcher being able to negate that hitter's skills and just matching it up. So like when you're surrendering that early run or two and all those things that you listed that you could be thinking at that moment, were you ever thinking like, well, I'm probably not going to be seeing that part of the opposing lineup again a second time around or a third time around? Like, did something like that ever cross your mind when you're pitching in the first inning?
No, not for me. You know, I was part of the last era of pitchers that were allowed to throw 130 to 140 pitches on a regular basis. There were so many games I pitched where I was through five innings and around 100 pitches where I thought, I've got two more innings left here. You know, I'm okay. I'm going to get through. I still got a chance to get through seven innings at 100 pitches after five. You know, I was going to throw 130, 135 pitches. These pitchers aren't going to be allowed to do that nowadays. It's just disallowed. They just, the managers would be fired if they allowed pitchers to do that on a regular basis. And they have more weapons in the bullpens. They have more pitchers, first of all, the way the rosters are constructed. All the extra players are in the bullpen, and rightly so. There's a lot of good pitchers down there to be used and to be had. So, no, to answer your question, Justin, I never thought about that. What I did think about, though, was how the other pitcher was throwing. And here's another sort of, you know, a perception that's out there that a lot of pitchers talk about. You know, I'm not facing the opposing pitcher. I'm facing the opposing lineup. Well, that's not necessarily true, because if you give up two in the first inning and then you look across at the guy who's pitching and he looks really sharp tonight, you might have just lost the game in the first inning, really, if the pitcher's that good and that sharp and then they've got a lockdown bullpen behind it. That's what I'm thinking about, you know, is that, this guy's sharp and I just gave him that much of an advantage to start this game off of.
Yeah, like what's going on inside the head of the opposing guy, the opposing starter, as he's graced with a lead before even throwing that one pitch in a postseason game. Like, how different is that feeling compared to the same situation in the regular season?
It's kind of twofold. First, it's comforting because you know you got a little cushion to work with. And secondly, there's a big responsibility with it. And everybody talks about shutdown innings. Well, certainly there's a message to be sent to your team, you know, that, hey, you gave me two runs to work with in the top of the first. Now, in the bottom of the first, I've got to go out there, and a quick 1-2-3 inning is a great statement to make just psychologically for your team. You know, I can't put a number on that. I can't tell you from an analytics standpoint, you know, what that means, but I know psychologically what that means to not only the pitcher on the mound, having that shutdown inning, but also to everybody in the lineup, everybody in the clubhouse, everybody in the dugout. When you walk back in that dugout after having a good, quick 1-2-3 shutdown inning, and you've already got a 2-run lead, boy, the feeling in that dugout just jumps, and it's palpable. You can definitely feel that confidence starting to breathe.
I'll blend this into, you know, the more positive tone when you're pitching a scoreless first inning. And we've seen that happen, obviously, in this postseason. We've seen what kind of tone that sets for certain teams. We saw it tonight, you know, game three of that Red Sox Astros series with Eduardo Rodriguez. James, how have teams fared in games where the pitcher tosses a scoreless first inning? Do the numbers really stack up there? And just overall with some of the big name pitchers, maybe this postseason, like where do you think we're at once you get through that hump, that first inning obstacle?
It's a little bit of a mixed bag because we've had a lot more games with a team scoring a first inning run. So a game like tonight with Eduardo Rodriguez and Jose Urquidy, they actually pitched 2 1-2-3 innings in both halves of the top and the bottom of the first. So that's only the second time this postseason we've even seen that with Lance McCullers and Lance Lynn in the ALDS in the White Sox Astros series. So it's almost like we don't really have much to go on because before we mentioned the 5.25 first inning ERA, we don't really have much of a sample to go off of. But generally speaking, if you stretch it out a little more, the records are obviously in favor of you know, you get that first inning zero, you put that donut up and get the offense back out there, and it's smooth sailing. Coney, don't sell yourself short, because your career ERA 3.46, career ERA in the first inning 3.93, which is really totally fine considering that most pitchers have their ERAs go up by a half a run or more. So that's pretty much in the norm for pitching in the first inning. A lot of pitchers have a lot of great pitchers have had a much bigger issue in the first inning. And, you know, between, you know, active pitchers that we've seen this year, Shohei Ohtani, Ian Anderson, Freddie Peralta, Luis Garcia, Garrett Cole, guys who have starred in the season, and we've even seen them in the postseason too, where they've had some shaky issues in the first.
Tom Glavine, so, Hall of Famer Tom Glavine, used to have a big issue.
Glavine is one of those guys, and Greg Maddux was the same thing. Maddux, 3.16 career RA, but 4.09 in the first inning. So it's almost like he became a pedestrian pitcher, and then after he gets over the hump there, then he's Greg Maddux. And what's interesting to me is seeing that even throughout baseball history, and as you know, the ebbs and flows, offense, errors that favor offense, errors that favor pitching. Two of the guys that I think that narrative really came on really strongly was Bob Gibson and Tom Seaver. And he's like, oh, with these, you know, the Hall of Fame type pitchers, the aces, you can only get them in the first. You have to strike before they really settle in. And even you see guys from, you know, a couple generations ago, Bob Gibson, 2.91 career ERA, first inning ERA, 4 on the nose. So that's a difference of more than a full run. And it's similar for Seaver, where he was just under a full run increase from his career ERA to the first inning. It was 2.86 career and 3.75 in the first, which is actually a little worse than it might seem, because they pitched in a pitcher dominant era where ERAs were generally lower to begin with. So the conventional wisdom of needing to strike against these ace pitchers early before they settle in, that's true. And Coney, you mention this all the time. It's really great when you see now we have the numbers for it. And it's stuff that always existed, and it's stuff that's always been, thought of in the game. But now it's like, oh, that thing that everyone just assumes, turns out it was actually right the whole time. And we just only now we have these kinds of things to back it up.
Yeah, that's a great point, James, because there's more common denominators than you think. That we take the narrative of, old school and new school, or analytics versus, more of a field type of baseball. There's more common denominators than you think there are. And there's more things that can be, explained like you just did, and sort of backed up, so to speak, than you would think. There's a lot of things that analytics have proved that a lot of old time baseball coaches have been talking about for years, and then there's some things that buck heads with it as well, but they go completely counterintuitive to some of the old theories. But there's more there than meets the eye, and there's more common denominators than you'd expect.
David, does one first inning of a postseason start stand out to you more than others over your career?
I think, to me, I always felt like when you're the home starter, that was something that was a little bit different, and that you really could get the crowd into it early. And if you could come out of the gates and look sharp right away, you get everybody in the stadium into the game, and you get a lot of intangibles going for you, whether that was at the old Yankee Stadium, how loud they could be. If you could get a strikeout to end in the first inning, and walk, walk on a cloud of air into the dugout, everybody was pumped up. I mean, that adrenaline that you get, that you can do yourself as a starting pitcher and the home starting pitcher to set the tone early, it means something. Now, yeah, obviously there's a lot of game to play. It's not everything. Things can be overcome. It's just one inning. It's a small sample, but boy, what a great way to start out your night. There's a few games I remember, starting the first inning at Yankee Stadium, and just, wow, the crowd was going, just exploding. And then you get into the dugout and the team is fired up because they can sense that, hey, well, yeah, our starting pitcher's got his good stuff tonight. Let's go. Let's score. Let's get him some runs, guys. It goes hand in hand in terms of the psychological nature of how you feel collectively as a team.
Well, how about the first game in the 95 ALDS at Yankee Stadium? It was the first postseason game for the Yankees since 1981. And it was a great run to the wild card and to sneak into the playoffs in the last weekend. And to have a raucous Yankee Stadium, you're pitching the first inning. And looking at this right here, first inning, 1-2-3. Vince Coleman, strikeout. Joey Cora, flyout. And then you got a guy named Ken Griffey Jr. to pop out. 1-2-3 on 11 pitches and into the dugout.
Yeah, that's the answer I would have said. Yes, that's the one to answer Justin's question. Yeah, that was as good as it gets. I mean, it was, as you said, James, you framed it perfectly. And it was Don Mattingly, Johnny Baseball's only taste of postseason play as well. So, yeah, that one was memorable, without a doubt.
Yeah, that was the series that brought the old place off the hinges. The place was shaking pretty much every game. That was wild, that 95 series against the Mariners. And, we look at this first inning now, how far we've come, right? David, like you said, you fall into some early trouble. You're not even thinking about, oh man, my time's going to be short here. I might have just sealed my fate. I feel like that has to creep into the pitchers that we're seeing today if they come into some trouble in the first inning. It's the human part of the game, right? Like, man, I probably just sealed my fate right here, even though maybe it was like one mistake. Take Ian Anderson the other night, and James, you brought him up. He has a spotty resume in first inning of games, even through the regular season. For all intents and purposes, Ian Anderson The other night in game two, he made one bad pitch and it resulted in a two-run homer from Corey Seager. And he ends up going three innings. If he does not make that one mistake pitch, is he going longer? Again, it's just one pitch. Like, does that personify the obstacle that is the first inning in this environment?
Yes, definitely does. It's a great point, Justin. And there's even more pressure nowadays on these pitchers because of exactly what you said. They know they're on pitch counts. They know that the relievers are lined up. The lanes, so to speak, are lined up so that, you know, if you have a big pitch count in the first inning, then you give up a couple of runs. Well, yeah, you're right. It could just completely alter your entire evening or your entire start. So, yes, even more so nowadays. You know, back, you know, if I was allowed to throw 130 pitches back in the 80s or 90s, then I'd have time to overcome it. You know, I could still get my stuff together. We can come back and score some runs. I've got a chance to really still stay in this game. But, you know, not anymore. You know, that's just not the way it's going to be played nowadays. Not with all the weapons that these managers have in the bullpens.
Do you think we've increased the toll in terms of what pitching in that first inning takes on you physically?
Yes. You know, and James can add some flavor to this, but yeah, without a doubt it does. It puts even more pressure on these pitchers, these starting pitchers. And also kind of lends credence to the whole opener strategy. The whole opener strategy is based around a lot of these numbers that we've been talking about, a lot of these issues. Everything about the first inning has kind of made the opener strategy attractive to the analytics world. And that's why even the Los Angeles Dodgers, as you say, are messing around with the opener strategy because they feel like maybe that's an advantage that they could use, you know, and maybe be the edge they need to get over the hump.
Yeah, and you mentioned with Anderson, well, one, he has a 3.58 ERA this year. In the first inning, 6.38. So that was a little bit of a red flag. And then Seager hits the home run, 2-0 like that. And one thing that I guess didn't really come up a lot with the talk around Anderson's start, but I think it's pretty significant. And maybe this is more of an off-season topic about, you know, the fight over the DH, universal DH, should the NL still have the pitcher's bat. But a big aspect of that was that Anderson, you know, you're in a quick 2-0 hole, and then his batting order spot comes up, and you pinch hit for him because you're down 2-0. You got to try and get some offense back in the game. If there was a DH in the National League, like a lot of the talk is increasing for that, you wouldn't have to pinch hit for him. And then maybe he's able to go back out there in the fourth or fifth inning and put up a couple of zeros like he did in the second and third inning after that. The flip side, because Coney, you mentioned, you know, the increased pressure on pitchers with shorter leashes. One flip side of it is you can kind of look at the other way for Eduardo Rodriguez. So going into the game, they were talking about maybe Eovaldi could be available for an inning out of the pen. Pivetta could be used in an emergency. And Rodriguez, especially with a big lead as the game was getting into a blowout, but he was able to get through six innings. But is the mentality now just go out and let it rip and we'll see what happens in the third, fourth inning? Because Rodriguez, he was throwing smoke in that first inning. And at the top, Justin, you mentioned the strikeout of Michael Brantley, who pretty impressive because he's one of the toughest guys in the league to strike out. But Rodriguez, he's a mid-90s fastball guy. The strikeout was 95.8 miles an hour. That was the fastest pitch he's thrown this season. So that's maybe it's a factor of, you know, not really holding anything back. And Coney, you can talk about this, just the pure adrenaline of being in a packed house in the first inning of a postseason game.
Absolutely. The human element, you know, it certainly comes through, and you could sense it from him, you know, and everybody feeds off of that. That's kind of what I was saying before, that your whole dugout, your teammates feed off of that. They sense it. They see it. You saw it, James, and we can now follow along every pitch and get data on every pitch that's thrown in a big league game now by just going to Baseball Savant and You can see anything you want to know on every pitch, vertical, horizontal movement, spin rate, vertical, whatever you want. You can find it out, but you see a pitcher pitching with that enthusiasm and that kind of stuff and that kind of sharpness too. I mean, it's one thing to get your adrenaline up and throw the ball harder. It's another thing to pinpoint it, to be sharp with it. It's like, yeah, I feel a little extra today. And also I'm putting it right on the black at the knees. You know, that's when you really, you get your teammates pumped up because everybody feeds off of that. They see that and they go, whoa, he's got it tonight. He's on, you know, as opposed to the opposing feeling of, you see a pitcher out there kind of nitpicking around, feeling for it in the first inning. And the next thing you know, you're sitting on the bench or your teammates are going, is he going to shit the bed tonight? He's going to shit the bed. We're going to be in trouble. So, you know, it's just the opposite of that. It's like, whoa, this guy is sharp. He's on. He's feeling it. Let's go. Let's get some runs. Let's get him a couple of runs because he's going to make it work. And we're going to win this game.
I think that situation right there pretty much like epitomizes the state of pitching in the postseason in 2021, right? You have Eduardo Rodriguez throwing gas faster than normal. All the chatter on Twitter is like, well, maybe he was told to just grip and rip because he's probably only going two innings or he's not going to see the lineup a second time through. Like, those are the thoughts that creep into your head. It's nice to see that he went six full innings, right? Like, it's nice to see after that start that maybe it was the adrenaline and him being amped up for this start at a raucous Fenway. The crowd's going crazy, especially at the start of that game. But those are the things we kind of have to question now, or at least put them out there where, you know, teams are exploring and employing different strategies with matchups the way we've seen it unfold. You know, the quality start in the postseason is kind of becoming an endangered species. I'm wondering, you know, what it's going to take to kind of tilt back into that direction. But hey, fellas, we have like a whole offseason to tackle those questions, right? We're off and rolling. This could be a good place to, you know, maybe stop and, you know, figure out what we want to see next or what could happen next, because you have, again, in the ALCS, you have one team right now pitching wise set up pretty nicely in the Red Sox, and on the other end with the Braves and the Dodgers, Atlanta, with those conventional starters, even though they had to do an unpredicted bullpen game in game two, they're still set up nicely because they have conventional starters. I think you're seeing which way I'm leaning.
Yeah, but sure.
But overall, I mean, hey, whatever gets the win at the end of the day. It's just interesting to see so much of what we're reminded of, you know, 100 plus pitches. Eduardo Rodriguez throws 97 pitches in game three. And you're getting at the point where I'm looking at his pitch count, like, man, I'm cheering him on to get to 100 just to say that he could do it here. And, you know, it didn't happen. But, hey, six innings, three runs. We see a quality start here in the postseason. And some of these teams are in a lot better shape than others on the pitching side. Makes it very interesting.
It does. Yeah, didn't the Braves used to play in Boston? Are we looking at like this franchise battle going on here? Is it going to be the Braves and the Red Sox in the World Series? Wow. I mean, that was probably the last pick for a lot of people coming into this postseason. But those are the two teams that are playing the best right now.
Yeah, the Braves did play in Boston in the early part of their run. So up until 1952, they were in Boston, and then they moved to Milwaukee. They had a 13-year run in Milwaukee, and then off to Atlanta.
There you go.
Boston and Atlanta on October 19th, right now, in the best shape in the postseason. Not too many people had that at the end of the regular season. And you guys got anything else as we wrap up?
It can change in a heartbat.
You're right.
The great thing with the momentum in this series is in a 7-game series, look at the Braves riding high off the two walk-offs. Walker Buehler, if he comes through with one big game and they get a win in game three, then the Braves can start to go, uh-oh. They were up 2-0 on the Dodgers. They were up 3-1 last year. And then that worm can turn pretty quickly in a 7-game series.
And despite everything that this industry is going through with the pitcher, it still remains true. You're only as good as your next starting pitcher, right?
That's true. You know, and how good he is in the first inning matters. So we'll see. Pay attention. If you don't see the first pitch of the game, you can't see the whole game. So watch the first pitch of the game. It's important. And watch the first inning.
Yes. Main message, if anything, in terms of taking away from our maiden voyage here on Toeing the Slab, don't be late. Get there for first pitch. Be in your seat for first pitch. Remind everyone, new episodes released every Tuesday. Look out for possible bonus episodes as well as we navigate through October and wrap up the postseason, as we still have the World Series to come, obviously, and these championship series, they still have to play out. And rate, review, subscribe. You want to make sure that you don't want miss any episodes. Best way to do that is to subscribe here to Toeing the Slab, Pitching with David Cone. Guys, we have like a bunch of different platforms from John Boy Media. The folks there are doing a terrific job getting us off the ground. Like, we have our own YouTube channel. We have our own Twitter account, our own Instagram account. So we're hooked up on the internet here. you want to follow the show everywhere you can. It's incredibly impressive what the people at John Boy Media are able to do with one specific stream and just spread it out at different avenues. So any way you get your content here, just make sure that you're consistent. Hit the subscribe button, rate and review, and we will talk to you next week. But possibly, hey, you never know in October, right? Like you mentioned, Walker Buehler could shove. Dodgers can go back 2-2. This is Pitching. You never know what's going to happen next. You may have a bonus episode coming your way. We'll have to see. Guys, it's been fun, this first episode.
Yeah, thanks, Justin. Nice job. James, good to see you as always. See you next time.
Guys. See ya. Enjoy the games, everybody. We'll talk to you soon.